Welcome back to episode number 260 of the Dust Safety Science Podcast. This is a podcast for building a global community around process safety and industries handling combustible dust. I'm your show host, Dr. Chris Cloney. Today's episode, we are discussing protecting from explosion risks in bucket elevators. We're doing that with Michel van der Weijer, explosion safety consultant at ISMA, based out of Antwerp, Belgium. Michel, welcome back to the Dust Safety Science Podcast. I'm super excited to have Michel back on. We had him on way back in episode 219 and 220, talking about the current status of combustible dust safety in Belgium and some example case studies. And today's episode, we're talking about bucket elevators. And so coming into what is now, I guess, our sixth year recording the Dust Safety Science Podcast, we're trying to find more specific topics that might be of interest to the audience. We look back at bucket elevators, and we did do hazard monitoring with bucket elevators way back in episode 145 and 146 with Brian Knapp from 4B Components. And that was much more on sensors to detect belt slip, belt alignment or misalignment, and those sort of devices for hazard monitoring systems. We want to have Michel on today to talk about explosion protection, both from a prevention side, which is a bit of the hazard monitoring, but then also protection side on these types of systems. Michel sent through a couple of articles for the Dust Safety Journal that we're organizing for publication now. One of those was around bucket elevators, which sort of sparked, I guess, to use a fire term, the idea to have him on the podcast here, get him back on from episode 220. So in this episode, we're going to talk about what is a bucket elevator? Why are they used in industry? What are different components? What are some of the hazards with regards to fire and explosions? And then what are some of the methods for prevention and protection, drawing on some of the examples that Michel has from his work? And I would say that we just got done at the time recording the 2024 Global Dust Safety Conference last week. And it was really inspiring to have, we had 250 people registered from 30 countries. A lot of the discussions were around what's going on in one part of the world and how can we apply that in another part of the world. And one of the things I really appreciate about that is kind of what we're going to talk about today, some research, some activities, some lessons learned out of Europe that is documented in technical reports written there and by the work of folks like Michel. What can we take and learn from that and apply here in North America? And vice versa, what are some things from NFPA 68 and 69 that we might be able to apply there? In Michel's experience, we're going to be talking a bit about the European side today. So, Michel, we talked a bit about your role in industry and what kind of work you do as an explosion safety consultant way back in episode 220. I guess before we get into the topic of bucket elevators, do you have just a short summary of what you do in industry and what kind of companies you help today?
Yeah, okay. As an explosion safety consultant, I advise companies on how to manage their explosion risks. As said before, we don't sell hardware. We only try to make the world a bit safer by giving specific recommendations and look for the best solution for the customer. So by doing so, we try to stay on the top of the different standards and all the different scientific work that is done in the field, and to really be up to par with the state of the art.
And I appreciate that. And I was going to add to that, you've been doing a bit of training for folks as well around ATEX and other things. I've seen some of your photos of you up front on these rooms training folks.
Yeah, of course. We provide training for safety advisors. In Belgium, it's obligatory for every company that has employees to have a safety advisor. And we try to train them specifically on the subject of ATEX, but also on graduation students in engineering courses and engineering studies. And also in the Netherlands, we give trainings to safety advisors and we are guest teachers at several universities, which is always nice to do and a nice activity and some variation in our work.
Good. Yeah, that's it's really important to train both the end users, the safety advisors, but also the students and those that are coming out into industry or even into consulting roles like yourself. Mm-hmm. So let's shift over to bucket elevators. So, I mean, a lot of the audience today would be familiar with a bucket elevator, but just to kind of get the basics out of the way, you know, when are bucket elevators used? And for someone who's not that familiar with it, if they have a facility that doesn't have bucket elevators, what are different kind of components that are in a bucket elevator and what's it used for at the end of the day?
Okay. Bucket elevators are indeed commonly found throughout the industry. And the basic principle is material is supplied at the bottom compartment of the unit, so to say. It's called the boot of the elevator. And inside this elevator, a belt or a chain scoops up the product using hundreds of buckets most of the time, and it transports vertically towards the top compartment. The top compartment is what we call the head of the elevator. The belt then rotates around pulleys and goes back down, and the product is thrown out at the head. The driving force of the elevator is positioned mostly at the head and makes the belt rotate and the buckets go up and down. These buckets, they move in ducts, sometimes round, sometimes squared. And these ducts are called the leg or the legs of the bucket elevator. You have double leg and single leg elevators, just how it's executed. In a single leg elevator, these buckets move up and down into one common leg, but mostly these are double leg elevators, one leg for the upward movement and the other leg for the downward movement. What is the specific use? They are capable to transport large volumes of material and are therefore used in industries with high tonnages. By example, a food and feed industry, grain handling, sugar companies, beer breweries for their malt supply and so on. The main advantage is that they require relatively little floor space. They only need the area for the boot, and the only way is up afterwards. It's just a vertical column, so it requires little floor space. A classic conveyor belt or chain requires more space to be placed because it can only go at an angle. It cannot go straight up in standard conveyor belts. These bucket elevators can easily reach up to 40 meters in height. That's why when you're driving through these industries, you can spot them from a large distance. They're easily recognizable. However, most often these installations are set up inside of production buildings, most likely in the middle of the facility. And this makes explosion protection not always that easy and straightforward. And unfortunately, these bucket elevators often need explosion protection.
Yeah, let's talk about that a bit. That gives a really good understanding of bucket elevators, what the different components are, some of the different configurations you might see, single leg versus double leg, inside facility versus outside of facility. You kind of mentioned if it's inside the facility, typically close to the middle because you want to have access to that material that's coming out of the head area to be distributed to different areas within the facility.
Yeah, as a lot of ink has already been spent on describing the specific risks of bucket elevators. And that is why there's even a European technical report specifically written for the problematics of bucket elevators. It's called the TR16829. It was released in 2016, but also in several NFPA standards, the specific dangers and risks regarding bucket elevators is discussed. As far as I know, they are mentioned in the NFPA 61, 68, and 69, but that's as far as my knowledge regarding the NFPA standards reaches, as since I'm a European, I'm not too familiar with them. But that's standardization and guidelines. The intrinsic danger actually comes from the following. To produce a fire or a dust explosion, you need an explosive atmosphere on the one hand, an ignition source on the other hand. And if they come together, you can get a dust explosion. First, the explosive dust atmosphere is produced in a few different ways. Most importantly, gravity plays a role. The buckets scoop up the product in the boot of the elevator. And since the bucket becomes full, product will fall back down and spillage from the bucket is inevitable. The heavy particles, they will fall faster and the fine particles will remain airborne in suspension inside of the bucket elevator. And this will result in the formation of a dust cloud in the upward leg and afterwards in the downward leg. Even if the amount of fines in the product stream is limited, the same phenomenon happens in the other leg. The product is thrown out at the head, but not all the product lands in the product outlet, and some product falls back down through the downward leg. Here also, the heavier particles fall faster, and dust tends to remain airborne and quickly builds up to explosive concentration. And in that regard, it's actually comparable to a dust filter. Dust concentration tends to build up due to the fine particles that remain airborne, and these heavy particles fall down faster. So actually, after this bucket elevator has been running for a while, it's completely filled with an explosive dust cloud. That's one thing. Also, a lot of mechanical movement happens in a bucket elevator, and this also contributes to dust forming. If you look at sugar, these crystals, they are pretty coarse, and crystallized sugar as such has no dust explosion risks. However, if you expose it to mechanical movements, these crystals are very brittle and they can break up relatively easy. And also, if the elevator is fed by mechanical transport, such as a screw conveyor or other systems with a lot of friction in it, this will also add to the amount of dust that is supplied to the elevator. So, in short, the gravity and the mechanical movement, this is why bucket elevators are very good in creating potentially dangerous explosive atmospheres. They just form a dust cloud by themselves. Normally, transport systems where product with limited amounts of dust, where limited amount of dust is transported, they are relatively safe because the dust does not easily build up to explosive concentration. And the main risk in these systems is due to the dust layers that are being formed on the inside of the casing, by example. And this is not true for a bucket elevator. Products with limited amounts of dust do not only pose a substantial risk, it is actually and probably the worst case possible, because when transporting pure dust, it is very well possible that the dust concentration even is too high to form a dust explosion and is situated above the upper explosion limit. This was even confirmed in experiments in England, where they tried to make a dust explosion in an elevator transporting pure starch or flour. During operation, it was simply not possible to create an ignition, or only a weak explosion occurred. And afterwards, in follow-up experiments in Germany, the same was witnessed. The most violent explosion was produced by starting up the elevator without any product feed. The dust that was present on the walls there and came loose due to vibration during startup was more than sufficient to produce a very strong dust explosion. So next to the formation of dust clouds, it is expected that the inside of the casing is covered in thick dust layers. And if something goes wrong, all this dust can also contribute to things going very wrong. So we can translate this into ATEX zoning. Since we are European-based, we use the ATEX zoning. And a bucket elevator is to be considered to hold a zone 20 inside. Same inside zoning as, by example, a dust filter. Only if very coarse products, like by example, large grain particles with very limited amount of fines is transported, or relatively wet product is transported, a zone 21 can be assumed in the inside. As an example, typically in sugar refineries, the fresh sugar that comes from the first dryers still contains a relatively high moisture content, and needs to be dried and processed even further. So the first bucket elevator in a sugar refinery can be considered as a zone 21, but all the other bucket elevators are often considered as a zone 20 inside, the worst situation possible. So that's the thing about the situation regarding zoning. We need to assume that there's almost permanently an explosive atmosphere inside the bucket elevator. So ignition sources must be eliminated with fairly high certainty. And that brings me to the next point, to create an explosion, a dust explosion. Next to this explosive atmosphere, we need an ignition source. And this is where a bucket elevator becomes very tricky. In other transportation systems, the general guidance is to limit tip speeds, by example, to 1 meter per second. That is actually how you can make a transportation system relatively safe. If you do so, reduce the speed to 1 meter per second. Metal-metal contact is believed not to have sufficient movement or kinetic energy to form hotspots or glowing particles. And by doing so, you eliminate potential ignition sources. However, if you would limit the tip speed of a classic bucket elevator to less than 1 meter per second, the product will no longer be thrown out, but will simply fall back down in the downward leg, and it will not work anymore. There are some tips and tricks to reduce that speed, but minimum speeds of 3 to 4 meters per second are fairly common in bucket elevators, and therefore they can give rise to ignition sources due to their high speed. Some examples: if the misalignment happens, but also impact on a bucket that comes loose, bearings that fail, slipping of the belt, and so on. There's a lot of things that can go wrong in a bucket elevator. And if these things go wrong, there's so much movement that they can heat up fairly fast. And since the inside of an elevator is to be considered to be a zone 20, all these faults must be prevented with a very high certainty. And when applying ATEX, this comes down to even a combination of two faults simultaneously happening that may not give rise to an ignition source, which is very hard to achieve. Give you a practical example. If we take a bearing that overheats, we can apply temperature monitoring, but you should consider temperature monitoring failing together with the bearing and still not resulting in an ignition source. But even if you could do this, even if you could exclude all the ignition sources that originate from the workings of the elevator itself, you must consider ignition sources entering the bucket elevator. Elevators are often used with biomass and organic material, and these products are well known for their ability to form smoldering fires under certain conditions. And also in a lot of processes, regarding these biomass and organic material, there is use of dryers and mills and other equipment that are very good in producing smoldering material and hot particles. In other words, even if you can exclude the ignition sources that are formed by the bucket elevator themselves, it is often very hard to exclude small hot particles from entering the elevator, the bucket elevator, with a sufficiently high certainty. And when they land in the boot of the elevator, they are surrounded by fuel and the fast moving bucket add a good amount of turbulence, and you have everything you need for the smoldering fire to quickly develop itself. And also in the rest of the elevator, there's plenty of fuel. And in combination with the legs that act as nothing more than a chimney, we have a fire that can develop extremely fast. If these conditions are ideal, this can result in a dust explosion, which actually happens fairly often.
Yeah, thank you for... So that was one of your courses right there, right? That was the first...
Approximately,
yeah. That was the 20-minute start on bucket elevator. If you want to go to Belgium and get some training with Michel and his team, there's the start on the session on bucket elevators. Sure, but I say that in joke, but it's actually tremendously valuable the way that you very simply explain the process and sort of build up the hazards. I want to move into some of the solutions, and you actually covered a lot of them here as well, and maybe some examples. But I'll do a bit of a summary of some of the key points as I heard them, and then try to also provide some context to other folks where they might be able to learn more. So I have my points labeled A through F. So I might have a few things to go through as well. But first one I want to mention was, you did mention this European technical report. That's TR-16829, released in 2016. I think maybe it was re-released in 2019. Do you know if that's the case, if a new version was released since 2016?
Yeah, it was an addendum, I think, or some corrections, but the basics remain the same and the global approach certainly remains the same.
Okay. Yeah, so that's called fire and explosion prevention and protection for bucket elevators. I used to have a copy. I tried to find it before this call and I couldn't. But the listeners, if you're in Europe, you may be more well-versed with these sort of standards. If you're in North America, you can find that online and purchase it through any of the standards development processes there. But just looking at the outline, it's got description of bucket elevators, fire and explosion hazards, talks through the presence of explosive atmospheres, potential ignition sources, the effects of ignition. I'd say those chapters are a lot of the stuff that Michelle just kind of went through and explained. But then a lot on the fire explosion prevention side, protection measures, lots of examples, and then guidance on venting, suppression, and examples of hazard assessment as well. So I was reading through some of the outlines, which you can find free online, of that document. And that'd be a really useful resource for folks trying to understand this area. So you mentioned a couple of really key things. I just want to kind of double click on some of them. The first is on a hazardous atmosphere inside the bucket elevators. And you kind of pointed to two key things here. You have gravity. So the reason we like bucket elevators is the small footprint. They go straight up and they can go really high. So you can get good bang for your buck for actually moving stuff up without taking up a lot of space. The downside of that is gravity is going to want to pull that material back down. So spillage at the boot, spillage at the head, spillage inside the system, and then falling back down all come into play in the system in a way that's sort of different than other pieces of equipment. And this, you really described it quite well. The heavy materials are going to fall down, but the fines are going to stay and disperse in the air, stick to the walls. And that's how over time you get these atmospheres built up. Either the dust is just present continuously in the air, or it's stuck to the walls and present and available when a dispersion event would happen. So that's sort of one side. Those are the fines that are just in that material normally. But even if you say, if you pre-screen that material before it gets into the bucket elevator, because of the velocities, and I think because of the tonnage, these equipment are specifically designed to move a lot of material. That's why they exist. If you're moving tons and tons and tons of stuff and feed and food, this is where this is a good process. So the velocity plus just the amount of material, even if you don't have fines in the system, you're going to generate fines through attrition with all the moving buckets, with the mechanical systems that are inside. So you could pre-screen the material, get rid of those fines, but you're going to generate it in these bucket elevators. And it's not normally just one, right? Sometimes it's one, depends on the site. If it's one within the center, then that's great. But if they have multiple products, if they have multiple, I don't know, dryers or systems that they need to keep moving material through, they're going to have bucket elevators in series connected to each other. And this attrition is going to build up that those fines over time. So that leads to, you know, hazardous area classification. You mentioned zone 20, continuously available inside the bucket elevators, potentially can be downgraded to zone 21 or zone 22. Well, to zone 21, depending on the type of materials that are involved. That goes from continuously to, you know, under normal conditions, there would be a hazardous area, flammable area, to, you know, short duration upset conditions. That kind of gives a really good summary around hazardous atmospheres in these dust collector, in these bucket elevators. On the flip side, you're going to have the high frequency of either generating ignition sources in them because of the mechanical movement, because of the bearings, misalignments of belts, all the mechanical components as they wear out or stretch or move, they can cause things to heat up in different ways. And you can also pull into that system ignition sources. So from a downstream dryer or a mixer or a size reduction piece of equipment, all these could pull in a smoldering mass. And you said it really well. In the boot is the perfect area to grow a fire. You have lots of material. It's oxygen, like in the pile, there's not a lot of oxygen. But as soon as that starts to get picked up by the buckets, you're going to oxygenate that. You have lots of turbulence. It's basically a great design system to take a small smoldering mass and make it a big smoldering mass and start a fire. And I think all those things combined, I mean, it switches every year. Some year it looks like dust collectors have the most explosions. In other years, it looks like bucket elevators have the most explosions. And some years, it's hard to tell. I'd say they're two of the most commonly cited equipment for the ignition location for dust explosion. And these are the sort of reasons why. And you compared it, you know, they're creating the same sort of atmospheres where we had this dust continuously available and the possibility of generating or transporting ignition sources into the type of systems. Hopefully, that was a bit of a good summary for the audience. If you want the full summaries, rewind back and listen to Michelle's summary of it as well. Anything else in there, Michelle, about the kind of setup of the hazards, what that looks like before we go into some of the prevention and protection side of things?
Could you repeat the question, Chris?
Anything else from the kind of setup, the discussion of the hazards from your experience that you've seen that folks should know before we kind of move into the protection side and the prevention side for explosions?
I think you mentioned really well. One of the in a lot of companies there are bucket elevators connected in series, And that's where things get really tricky. Huh? They always produce a lot of dust, and the dust gets transported and accumulates in all these bucket elevators. And it only takes one point to go wrong to make an explosion propagate throughout the whole facility. And since these bucket elevators are most often connected to a dust collection system with dust filters, it's good to have a complete installation blown apart. Yeah.
And so we kind of have a good setup of understanding how the hazards come about in these bucket elevators. We talked a bit about hazard monitoring, which would be sort of a first line defense to prevent fires and potential explosions. What other, you know, what other methods of prevention and protection would be looking at to protect from a dust explosion or a fire in a bucket elevator system?
Yeah, you could try to limit the tip speed, as I've said, but it's simply not possible in a classic bucket elevator. In addition, this 1 meter per second limit is mainly for metal-metal contact. And when using materials with high friction coefficients, this safe limit is actually no longer valid and should no longer be applied. And the heating can go even faster. What you have in an elevator, these belts are most typically made from anti-static flame retardant material and not metal. And in case of misalignment and in combination with high speeds and forces, this leads to hotspots very fast. I still visit companies where they claim misalignment detection is in place and perfectly maintained and regularly tested and all what you want. But if I take a look at the equipment, I see a nice circular shaped marking at the outside, at the exterior or the of the head and the foot. And this actually means one thing: the belt is misaligned and had friction against the casing, against the inside of the casing. By this friction, so much heat was created that the paint on the exterior of the casing was discolored. And this, for me, is one of the most important indicators that misalignment detection does not work properly. Any company that has bucket elevators, I would strongly suggest to have a good look at their head or their boots to look for these markings, these circular markings. And if such markings are found, you should act immediately. And after inspection and verification of your misalignment detection, please repaint the head so that any new misalignment stands out and not like, oh, that line on that casing has already been there for years. So that's actually a pretty good trick to see if a misalignment works. And that's one thing I really want to give away with for these persons.
Yeah, I think that's a really great. So once you fix it, yeah, paint over it so that you know if it comes up again. You mentioned, so there's a couple pieces there that we're probably not going to get to in this episode, but I'll point to episode 244. Of the Dust Safety Science podcast, which I kind of forgot about until you mentioned the buckets and belts rubbing against the side of the casing. And so that's a help desk question with Brian Knapp. Again, talk about alignment sensors for bucket elevators in NFPA 61. He talked about why you might consider having redundant sensors, why you might consider having multiple sensors on either side. And some of the things that come up here, and I think this is probably hinting at what Michelle is saying, where a company says, hey, we have alignment sensors. So what Brian talked about in that episode was things like, the casing can shift, the casing can warp, you could have a local deformation, like a local, the casing's banged up on one side. Any of these sort of things could cause one of those sensors not to be detecting a misalignment, but still having the belt the belt rubbing against the edge of the casing. In a lot of those cases, that's why, at least from my recollection of that discussion with Brian back in episode 244, why you see this case where you get rubbing anyway, even when you have alignment sensors. And we spent a good 45 minutes in that episode, which you can get access to at dustsafetyscience.com/244, talking about why those misalignments happen and then how you might use redundant sensors to understand and protect from those. And like Michelle said, once you actually investigate the thing, paint the casing so you know if it happens again. And I shouldn't say if it happens again, probably when it happens again, so that you can understand that. Anything else in this area for prevention and protection, Michelle?
Yeah, and this is where I base myself strongly at the TR16829. But actually, that's all fairly logic. Huh? You should install temperature monitoring on the bearings, huh? Especially in food and feed companies. These bearings are often placed on the outside. And it's not always as clean as it should be. In any way, a bearing is known to fail sooner or later. And if they fail, these tend to become very hot in a very short period. And if the outside of an elevator is not too clean, and we often encounter bearings that are buried in dust piles, this does not contribute to the lifespan of a bearing in a very good way. So bearings, put them outside, put temperature monitoring on them, but keep them clean. That's very important. Another thing is slip detection. If an elevator gets blocked or if an elevator is overloaded, slip can occur between the belt and the pulley. And this will also lead to intense friction and heat generation. You have misalignment detection, as we've spoken of before. You should install an anti-run back brake, because if you take a bucket elevator, if it's in operation, the upward side, these buckets are all filled up, and in total, it's an immense amount of weight, and the downward buckets are all empty. And if something goes wrong, by example, failure of a pulley, the difference in weight between the two sides will cause the belt to run back, possibly at an extremely high speed. It just get launched inside of the casing. It should come to no surprise that this is a high risk, and it can produce an ignition source fairly easy. Also, the belt material is of importance. Since the speeds in such an elevator are relatively high, static phenomena could start to play a role. And placing a purely isolating belt, by example, a simple rubber belt, is actually constructing nothing more than a giant Van der Graaff generator. It's a very impressive and fun apparatus at science fairs. However, in combustible atmosphere, it's a bit less interesting. Therefore, this belt should be made of anti-static material to avoid strong electrostatic discharges. In addition, the used material is best also to be flame retardant, so in case something goes very wrong, the belt does not act as an additional fuel and will not catch fire in case of heavy friction. So these are all things that you could do to make your bucket elevator safe by itself. But even if all these measures are in place and if they are well maintained, things can still go very wrong. The preventive measures do not protect against the entry of an ignition source. And that is the clue with bucket elevators. Malfunctions in upstream equipment, hot work, self-heating of biomass, and plenty of other things could lead to smoldering material entering the elevator. And this, like we said, will settle in the bottom of the elevator, and all conditions are there to form a nice big fire. The fast moving buckets that pass by and actually pump up the fire and make it develop even further. But also ingress of metal rods and other objects that don't belong in there can lead to the formation of an ignition source inside the bucket elevator, even if you added all the protection measures that were discussed earlier. Therefore, in most elevators, it is not possible to sufficiently exclude ignition sources by these preventive measures alone, and they should be protected against the consequences of an explosion.
Yeah, and I think that's where we should kind of go to close off the loop on bucket elevators. And so at the end of the day, a lot of things we talked about so far are preventing an explosion. What that's going to do is reduce the frequency of incidents that you're having, both fires and explosions in your bucket elevators, reduce product loss, reduce downtime, certainly, you know, reduce the risk of somebody being injured. But on the other end of the day, you generally need to plan for an explosion event when it does happen and have protection measures in place for that. So what kind of protection measures are people typically looking at for bucket elevators?
The easiest way to protect the bucket elevator is, like in all industrial installation, we place vent panels on it. The weak spots that release the flame and pressure produced by an explosion and that keep the resulting pressure to an acceptable level. And the technical report that we mentioned even specifically provides guidance on at which distances these should be placed based on the KST of the product and the maximum allowable pressure in the elevator. So it actually takes you by the hand and it designs the elevator protection for you. And a lot of companies did this that way. However, most bucket elevators are positioned indoors and it's not acceptable to place vent panels indoors. We still encounter indoor vent panels without any additional provisions on a regular basis. But you can imagine personnel walking in the vicinity of an opening vent panel is put at a serious risk. If the surroundings of the elevator are covered with dust, which is also happening a lot in food and feed industry, it is not a good idea to allow a fireball of several meters to be blown inside such a facility. You could apply flameless vents, but this must be done with extreme caution. In an earlier episode of this podcast, Dimitrios Kakogiannis of, I think, Fike, I believe, he elaborated pretty good that these flameless vents have limited efficiency, and it's actually very complex to correctly assess the efficiency of those devices. Also, just putting flameless vents on the bucket elevator does not take you out of the woods completely. Safety distances for personnel and equipment are still required in most cases. The metal mesh by which a flameless vent is constructed, it will extinguish the flame, but it still produces a fairly loud bang, and hot gases will still pass through this mesh, and it's not a nice place to be standing right next to if something goes wrong. However, the most important problem with venting, if you do it flameless or not, the problem is you also need explosion isolation. If we look back at the dust filter, isolation is often achieved with a rotary valve in the product outlet and a non-return valve in the product inlet. However, if you would apply a rotary valve on the outlet of a bucket elevator, this won't work. There's no rotary valve that can transport such large amounts of product that are used or that are transported by a bucket elevator, especially when looking at existing bucket elevators. So that is actually what brings us to the only alternative that is often applicable, and that are explosion suppression systems, also called high rate discharge or HRD systems, depends on the manufacturer. The idea of these systems is that a highly sensitive detector sees an explosion and starts developing and sees an explosion developing, and it activates a suppression system. This activation can be triggered by pressure, light, or combination of both. But in any case, the system blows in a sufficient amount of extinguishing powder, for example, sodium bicarbonate, at a very high rate. The advantage of sodium bicarbonate is logical. It's easy, it's food safe, and it's a good fire extinguishing agent. However, these systems have some disadvantages. The biggest advantage of this system is that it also can be used for isolation. In that case, it's called a chemical barrier. And if the inlet and outlet are also filled with extinguishing powder, the flame cannot pass and the explosion will also stop there. Also on the elevator legs, in most cases, it is considered that an explosion starts in the head or the boot. Therefore, if you place this high rate discharge system on the head, which takes care of suppressing the explosion, and a chemical barrier rightly below the head, it will take care of the isolation of the legs. And the same approach is used at the booth. What you don't want is a flame accelerating inside of these elevator legs, because you get phenomena like pressure piling and extremely high pressure that an elevator will not withstand. Alternatively, chemical barriers can be used as an isolation system in combination with venting, but this should be done with great care. Venting causes air displacement, which could have blown the powder away before the flame arrived. So if you want to do this, please use expert advice. If required, one or two additional bottles can provide isolation of the inlet and the outlet, and can also isolate dust extraction lines and everything that is connected to the elevator where you don't want flames to pass through or propagate through.
Yeah, really helpful to go through those different options for venting, we'll call traditional venting, flameless venting, isolation mechanisms, suppression systems, chemical barriers. Really lots of really good, too much good information there. What I appreciate that you went through is the kind of pros and cons of each, and when you use them in conjunction, how you might run into issues. Like if you use venting with suppression, then you may get suppression blowing out the vent holes, which isn't great. And several other key points there. You did mention our podcast interview with Dimitrios from Fike discussing flameless venting. We actually at our conference last week at the Dust Safety Conference, our online 3-day event, there was lots of discussion around flameless venting as well. New testing standards, new certification requirements. And the key takeaway there was to really make sure you understand the limits of the certification and then what limits are in that certification. So kind of two pieces. What's it certified for? What type of material? What type of volume? What type of, you know, the other considerations that it's certified for? And then also to ask the right questions to figure out how it was certified and make sure it's going to be safe for your application at the end of the day. There's a lot here, and you mentioned a couple things. So one that you probably need expert support to understand, design the overall protection methods for these type of systems. You did also mention at the very outset that ISMA, ISMA, doesn't sell hardware. You guys are really trying to figure out the right solution for an end user. I guess that kind of brings the question is, how do you go about actually trying to figure out for a given application, which combination of prevention methods and protection methods are needed for a given set? And I guess in general, high level, we can't go through every scenario here in the podcast. Maybe we will on future ones. I don't know, depending on how your schedule opens up. but in general sense, like what's the process look like to understand, evaluate what type of these options we might be looking for a given facility?
Yeah, of course, the first question is how strong is our bucket elevator? If it has no strength whatsoever, by example, if it's only produced with sheet metal of 1.5 millimeter thick, actually, we cannot go even further. We actually cannot go further because the reduced pressure will still be higher than the strength of the bucket elevator. We could calculate this pressure, the maximum allowable pressure, but that's the first point. How strong is our bucket elevator? Secondly, is this thing standing inside or not? Is it allowed to have venting on it? But that's actually rarely the case. Even when they are standing outside, you don't want flames of 20, 30 meters blown across the environment. And the suppression system are often the way to go.
Really helpful. So we got how strong is the elevator? And then is it inside, outside? What's close to it? And there's been quite a bit of work in this over the years, and that technical report would be a good thing to point back to for folks that are interested more in this area. I think for today's episode, we covered a lot of ground on prevention and protection in bucket elevators. Any final words for folks in this area and things they should be thinking about?
Yeah, too often we get consultants in the design phase of a new plant or new installations. And then the primary approach is avoid using standard bucket elevators. There are safer alternatives and they are widely available on the market. And in most cases, alternative case techniques can be used. An example is a so-called Z elevator. These are slowly moving bucket elevators and they use rotating buckets that tip over at the outlet. And they are much safer since they don't have these high speeds and therefore are generally considered safer. Because they don't have high speeds, they don't have these mechanical ignition sources that could be formed, but also they produce fairly a lot of less dust. Other techniques that could be used are disc fairs. They have almost no free space where dust clouds can be formed. However, there are a few exceptions where a bucket elevator is really needed. If you really need these high tonnages that can be transported, these high amounts of products, or if they are already in place, the resulting risks must be considered really carefully. And I think it's of great importance that companies that use bucket elevators are aware of the risks. Good maintenance of all these preventive measures is key, but is still often overlooked. And then the implementation of protection is a good step towards a safer production plant, but often at a large cost especially when using suppression systems. These systems are extremely expensive, and unfortunately, the total cost does not end after installation. Since most of these systems use permanently pressurized vessels, they must be in compliance with pressure equipment directives, which results in additional requirements and costs. But also, systems that are not permanently pressurized require regular maintenance by trained external technicians. But another important difficulty of protecting an elevator is this need for sufficient strength. These thin-plated large elevators are weaker than an average vent panel and will fail even before the vent panel opens. The same goes for using suppression. You need a certain strength to allow the system enough time to react and also withstand the resulting forces of this powder injection. It goes with such an extreme speed and force, and you don't want this powder injection to rip out the side panel of the bucket elevator. We could calculate it, as we said, an elevator can be reinforced as we want, but it's not always possible, and this can become quite expensive. The most important downside, to my feeling, is these systems are very sensitive, and it makes it possible for them to activate when it's not necessary. Too often, we hear about an operator that did not follow LOTO procedures, lockout tagout procedures, correctly. He opened equipment without the suppression installation being switched off. In chemical or other high-risk environments, this is almost unthinkable. However, in food and feed companies, there is a strong lack of awareness, and LOTO procedures are not always implemented well. And you can imagine what happens if they start cleaning inside equipment and they hit the pressure sensor of the suppression system. What also adds to that problem is that elevators are equipment that often overfill. By example, by an obstruction in the outlet, and product gets pushed against the detector or things like that. And an unwanted activation of an explosion suppression system quickly adds up to thousands or even tens of thousands of euros in replacement parts and the resulting production loss and production delays. And the person that is responsible for it, the operator that did not pay attention to LOTO procedures or had the elevator overfill, he will not be having what we call his best day at the job.
Yeah, tremendously valuable summary. A lot of really important points there, from getting things in at the design phase, some different options there that might be alternatives to bucket elevator systems. You mentioned Z elevators and disc conveyors as options there. Some challenges with suppression systems. And certainly these also, I mean, any explosion protection device needs to be designed adequately. We had some presentations at the Dust Safety Conference of failure of suppression systems when, say, the nozzles are buried. Wouldn't happen as much in an elevator, but potentially in a bucket or in a dust collector. If the nozzles are placed below the fill line of that material, that caused a couple of loss incidents that were discussed at the event. There's been some recent explosions in North America that I believe were due to failure to maintain bottle pressure and some other things in there. So it comes all back around to understanding what the options are, doing an assessment both from a safety and a compliance and a cost basis, one-time capital cost and overtime, trying to figure out what system's going to be best for the company involved. And that's where folks like you come in, Michel, and trying to, you know, help people understand what the different options are. So I want to say thank you so much for your time today, for coming back on the podcast. I guess this is your third interview on the podcast. We appreciate it so much, the way you're able to spell things out very simply. I know English is not your native language, but you do quite a good job going through this stuff with English. And I don't think I'd be able to contribute near as much if we went with your native language in the interview. So thank you so much for coming on today. And we hope to have you back on the podcast in the future.
Thanks, Chris. Please let me know if I can contribute anything else. No issue. And thanks for your great job, and my compliments for the past conference, the Dust Safety Conference.
Thank you so much, Michel. We'll be talking soon.
Yeah. Thanks. Bye.
So you've been listening to myself, Dr. Chris Cloney, and Michel van der Weijer, explosion safety consultant with ISMA, based out of Antwerp, Belgium. And that is isma.be is their website in Belgium. We'll have a way to contact Michel in the show notes for this episode at dustsafetyscience.com/260. some links to some of the material we discussed as well. We went through a full ride of bucket elevators, what they are, why and how the hazards arise from dust fire and dust explosion perspective, methods of prevention, and methods of protection. We went through a lot of details in this area. A couple of things I pulled out was the technical report 16829, 16829, and that's the European technical report that covers fire explosion prevention and protection in bucket elevators. A lot of this material would come and be available in that, so that's a really good resource for folks. We covered a couple of podcast episodes, dustsafetyscience.com/22244 and 249. So 244 was alignment sensors for bucket elevators with Brian Knapp, and 249 was flameless venting with Dimitros. And I'm not going to attempt to say his last name on the podcast again. You can go to episode 249 to hear my butchered attempt the first time. And then the previous episodes with Michelle, 220 and 219. And a couple of things that we talked about towards the end was around flameless venting, vent design for bucket elevators. There's some really important things happening globally in both of these technologies and others on the explosion protection and isolation side. One of the big things that comes out for multinational companies is if you look at NFPA and the European standards for explosion venting on bucket elevators, you're going to get different answers on the vent spacing and vent area required on a bucket elevator. We don't have a podcast episode covering that, but we do have some presentations available in the Dust Safety Academy from past conferences on that topic. And then we'll have all the presentations for flameless venting, which you talked about a lot last year and this year in the Dust Safety Academy that you can get access to in there as well. So I want to say thank you to Michelle for coming on. Ton of valuable information here. You might need to replay, get your notepad out and listen through it again to try to capture all the tidbits. But there's a lot of really good stuff in there. As always, I want to say thank you for listening to the Dust Safety Science podcast. Hope you have a safe and productive week ahead. I appreciate everything you're doing in industry handling combustible dust. Make it safer with the work you do with there every day. Keep it up.